I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN. What makes us, as humans, different? Even, shall I say, better than monkeys? I mean, Charlie Darwin was pretty sure we were cousins, so how is it they're still spending their days swinging from trees and we, well, don't, usually? Well, I'd like to think at one point we learned to use tools, to reason, to think independently. We began to create a world around us, full of art and music. This is when we became, and I'm going to say it, better than our banana-eating cousins. Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys. You know, it was 1988 when Michael Sacks won the principal trumpet position in the Cleveland Orchestra. He was stepping into a very elite ensemble in a very elite position. You see, of all the orchestras in the United States, and there are about 1,200 or so of them, five hold a very special place. The Big Five, as they're known, New York, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Cleveland, are revered for their musical excellence and their high caliber of musicianship. Now, each of those orchestras has only one principal trumpet. Thousands of players spend years preparing and practicing on hope alone that one of these elite positions will actually come available, and that's rare too. Players can stay in an orchestra position for 30 or more years. So of the myriad of players that aspired to play with the Cleveland Orchestra, Michael Sacks was the one good enough to be offered the position. In the sports world, that would be the equivalent of winning Wimbledon or gold at the Olympics or the Masters or pitching for a World Series champion. What makes his appointment even more remarkable is that he followed a very unusual path to get there. Just wait till you hear his inspiring story. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Michael Sacks as we unpacked his own story. We talk all things trumpet, delve into his love of sports, talk about our favorite players, and find out what it's really like to be considered one of the finest trumpet players in the world. Today's guest on Better Than Monkeys, the Cleveland Orchestra's own Michael Sacks. So I was doing a little reading about you in some of your biographies, and it turns out that you didn't necessarily major in music as your undergrad. It looks like you were a history major starting out.
Yeah, I took a very different path to where I ended up than pretty much just about everyone else in this business that I've known over the last 40 years. The whole way that started is, growing up, music was a big part of my life, but my parents weren't musicians. My dad had nothing to do with music. He was as tone deaf as they get. I mean, we would go to we had Rams season tickets in LA, and he would sing the national anthem, and it was just, I mean, maybe if he got one note right the whole way through, he was, you know, lucky. And my mom, on the other hand, always loved playing piano. And she kind of had a repertoire of Brahms and Chopin and Beethoven. She would just kind of sit down and knock out every now and then. And she loved to listen to classical music. So I grew up with that. And classical music in Santa Monica, where I grew up, was huge in the schools. So playing trumpet for me was just another activity, along with football, baseball, and, you know, all sorts of other sports I was involved in. But music was always at the forefront, playing the trumpet. I started when I was very young. I was only 6 and a half when I started. But going through school, I was in all the groups. I was in the, you know, orchestras and the bands, and the marching bands, the jazz ensembles. I was in rock bands on the side, playing on the horn band, you know, Chicago, Earth, Wind, and Fire kind of stuff.
Right.
But when it came time to go to college, my dad's path that he wanted me to take was to go to college and eventually get either an MBA or a, you know, get a law degree and pass the bar, and then eventually swing around and take over his business. And I was conflicted because my teacher at the time wanted me to go to Eastman Conservatory of Music in Rochester, where he had gone. And so I was very conflicted. You know, I kind of wanted to play trumpet, but my dad was kind of pushing me this other way. So I kind of split the difference. I ended up going to UCLA. And while I was taking trumpet on the side, doing all the playing of a music major, I was actually a history major. So I was doing all the playing. I just wasn't taking the classes.
Practically a double major.
Pretty much. But in some ways, it was kind of nice because I was able to fly a little under the radar. I mean, I was involved in a bunch of stuff at UCLA and a couple of orchestras that were primarily, you know, a lot of the more advanced, the top university and just postgraduate, you know, players. So I was playing with all those guys, but I just wasn't taking all the theory and the music history and the piano and all the other ancillary stuff that any music major would be taking. Right. I was taking, you know, mostly American history between Civil War, World War II, and a little bit of a minor in Japanese history. So I was, you know, kind of living, you know, this dual life in both of these worlds.
Did your teachers at UCLA see any promise in you at that point and try to steer you away from the path you were already on?
Well, the people I was studying with were outside of school. I was studying with, you know, a couple of very strong teachers in the LA area, but they weren't affiliated with UCLA. And I played in the marching band my first year, mostly because my sister was in the marching band. I wanted to be with her with that. And then I played the wind ensemble the first couple of years. But most of the stuff I did, you know, trumpet-wise and music-wise was out of school. I mean, everything else, I mean, I had a normal college life. I lived in a fraternity for 4 years. I was a history major. I took econ classes and communications classes and business classes. And kind of had a really just kind of basic college life, but I kind of had this dual personality, that this other side of me that the whole time was practicing trumpet and playing in these groups and kind of cultivating that side of things. After my sophomore year at UCLA, I was encouraged to do a summer festival at Tanglewood, the summer home of the Boston Symphony,
right,
with a group called the Empire Brass Quintet, was doing a seminar. So I went to this 4-week seminar, and that was kind of a mini light bulb moment, like, wow, this is really fun just focusing on music, and I really enjoy it. I'm having some success. You know, I've always had in the back of my mind is something I'd like to do, but it was really the next summer when I went to the Aspen Music Festival in Aspen, Colorado, and I spent 9 weeks just performing music and studying music. And that's really when I had the epiphany that this is what I need to try to do. I'm going to kick myself the rest of my life if I don't try to do this, or at least take the shot.
Now, you're already 4 years behind your contemporaries at this point, technically. Because you did your undergrad, well, a couple of years anyways. So is this where the big shift came and you just pushed all your efforts into becoming a trumpet player?
Pretty much. I mean, that was the summer I was 20. So, you know, it's very late for, you know, most people there, you know, at a conservatory from age 17, 18 on and really immersed in this. But the fact that I was immersed in the musical part of it, of just playing the trumpet and expressing myself musically, I just wasn't dealing with the academic part. So one of the people that I met that summer at Tanglewood between my sophomore and junior years when I was 19 was Mark Gould, who's was the principal of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and teacher at Juilliard. And I happened to be going to New York City right after that. And I was going to take one lesson with him. It turned into three, and we immediately hit it off. And I felt that chemistry. And I realized that my next step was to try to go to New York and study with him. And luckily, I got accepted into a studio at Juilliard. So I went to Juilliard as a 21-year-old freshman. Going into it, I felt like, you know, my gosh, I'm 4 years behind all these guys. These guys are way ahead of me. And while to an extent from an academic standpoint and a knowledge-based standpoint, technically, yes. But from a musical standpoint and a trumpet standpoint, no. I mean, I was very competitive with that and felt pretty decently about my opportunity to really give this a shot at that point.
We have a small Mark Gould connection. It's very small. It's tenuous at best. But he came and played with the Erie Philharmonic in like 1986, 1987, perhaps. Bob Dolick, my old trumpet teacher, was the principal in the Erie Philharmonic. Uh-huh. And we did a trumpet trio together called Cornet Chop Suey.
I kind of remember, you know, it's funny you mention this. It rings a bell. I kind of remember him telling me that he was going to Erie and going to, because I know he played that piece. He was going to play that piece. Because I know he did that quite a bit with the New York Trumpet Ensemble. I think that was a piece he played quite a bit. And the connection with me, besides Gould, is your former teacher, Bob Dolick, was playing quite a bit with the Cleveland Orchestra.
Absolutely. He studied with...
Before I got here in my first couple of years.
Right. When he was in school, he studied with Charlie Schluter and Bernie Adelstein. So, of course, he was playing in the Cleveland Orchestra all the time. Back when I was in college, still, we'd go all the time and see the Cleveland Orchestra.
And Bob's a terrific player, man.
He is. He's retired now.
Yeah.
So he's taking it easy right now. But he was a great guy to go to school with. He taught me a lot. I got my chops from him. So you've done the college thing. Now you're going to Juilliard, right? And you're studying music with Mark. And you're kind of progressing on this path now towards being an orchestral player and a soloist. And when you take your first big jump, what was that big jump from being a student to going, I can do this professionally. Here's my first professional gig.
Well, I mean, there's kind of a sequence leading up to that. There were a couple summer festivals that I did. One was called Colorado Philharmonic, that's now called National Repertory Orchestra. That was in Evergreen, Colorado at that time. Now it's in Breckenridge. But that summer, those two summers in 83, 84, between my senior year at UCLA, my first year at Juilliard, and then between my first and second year at Juilliard, being in that orchestra, being around that caliber of players, playing a ton of repertoire for the entire summer was a huge learning curve. Because part of the thing for me was that I was a little behind the curve as far as my knowledge base of repertoire and my experience playing repertoire. So having two summers playing in an orchestra for 9 weeks each, going through 2-3 concerts a week of repertoire was phenomenal. And then when I was at Juilliard, there was a performance of the Strauss piece, Also Sprach Zarathustra, which has a big trumpet part, and a very famous trumpet part. And I got to play principal on that. And I just had some breakthroughs in my playing and playing that piece. And it was a really successful performance for me. At the end of that piece, I sat there on stage and I thought, you know, I think I can do this. It was the first time I kind of had the epiphany of thinking, I think I can really do this, and having that kind of confidence building moment. And then about 6 months after that, I won my first position, which was fourth utility in Houston. I won my first audition.
So that was 83, 84, right?
That was, maybe, that was
84, 85.
The Zarathustra was in 85. And then I got my Houston job in October of 85 and then started in June of 86.
The reason that's so impressive is because it wasn't very long after, it was 1988 or so, that you won the Cleveland position, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
So you went from fourth utility to principal trumpet in one of the finest orchestras in the world in a matter of 5 years.
Yeah, from my time starting at Juilliard until my time in the Cleveland Orchestra was 5 years.
I mean, that's pretty meteoric as far as.
I was only in Houston for a little over 2 years. But again, the experience in Houston playing fourth utility was a perfect place for me to hone my skills to prepare to play principal, actually. Because playing fourth utility, I was playing second, third, fourth, assistant first, and I was on stage more than any other guy in the section. So I got a ton of repertoire under my belt. I watched a lot of guys with a lot of experience in an orchestra with terrific musicians and gained a lot of insight into both do's and don'ts as far as if you're in a principal role, if you're in a section role, and really understanding how orchestras work and how, what the roles are in the orchestra. And I had known that to an extent, but really a deep dive into that of understanding. And I talked with a lot of the older guys and got a lot of information to get up to speed and understanding of how the roles work, how the teamwork, was put together. So that when I got here, I had a very clear understanding of the role I was walking into, not to mention, Bernie Adelstein, my predecessor, who was a phenomenal, player, one of the pillar players in the world for, 30, 40 years prior. And of course I knew of Bernie. I didn't know Bernie. I had met him in passing very, very quickly after Cleveland Orchestra concert when I was in New York. But other than that, I'd never spoken with him before. I had gotten the job and, got a chance to know him a bit, but it was a big responsibility, taking over and taking over that position that he left. It's such a high standard.
And it was such a well-established section at that time. Did you find it tough to step in as the boss of a new section? They've been there for a long time by that point.
Yeah. I was the first new guy in, I think, 15 years.
Right.
And, that's a long time for a team to be together. And, the short answer is it was really easy. A lot easier than I thought it would be. And just to elaborate on that a little bit, I mean, the fact that I was going into such a stable environment with three other guys who were wonderful guys and wonderful players, that I couldn't have asked for a better supportive team to be joining. I mean, it was very functional and very cohesive and stable. And that was extremely good. And also to have the luxury of sitting next to David Zauter, the longtime second player personnel manager, who sat next to Bernie for 28 years, who had that knowledge base, who played with Zell for 12 years, and who really, quite honestly, became as much a father to me as my own. I mean, Dave and I were very, very close. And really what it came down to is I realized very quickly that as long as I was prepared and aware and listening around me and assimilating and fitting in, just coming in and just fitting my piece of the puzzle in, everything was going to be fine. I realized early on that if something was off, something was out of tune, or something wasn't quite right with ensemble, it was probably me. everybody else was just bang, right.
Locked
on
in.
Everybody else, their radar was so finely tuned. and understanding the acoustics of Severance and knew each other's playing so well that it actually was very, very easy, much easier. I mean, going into it, I thought, my gosh, how am I going to do this? But about 15 minutes into the first rehearsal, which was at Bruckner 9, I thought, okay, I just have to fit with everything around me and everything's going to be fine.
Who was the major conductor when you started? Was it Christoph Andochnany when you started?
Andochnany was the music director and the one who hired me, and I worked with him my first 14 years.
I never got to meet him, but he did sweat on me during one concert. We were sitting right in the front row at Severance Hall, and I think it was a performance that Bob took us to of La Mer. And for some reason, the seats we got were front center, and he was throwing his hair, and it was just hitting us in the audience, and it was like being baptized, sort of. So we were all good with that.
Could have given you, slicker or some one of those
slicker towel, little umbrella or something. But you've played with some of the greatest conductors in the entire world over the course of your career. Of course, Boulez and Schulte and Akhnani and Guerrero. Who do you think is the one conductor you haven't worked with yet that you really would look forward to doing some kind of a project with?
Wow, that's a tough question. I mean, there are conductors that I would have loved to have worked with who are no longer with us, like the Claudio Abbados, who I saw conducting Chicago and London, but I never got to work with him. Giolini, who I saw conducting in LA, who was just sensational. I did get to work with Bernstein once, not in Cleveland, but when I was at Tanglewood, I got to work with him. Interesting enough, it was an all Copland concert, and he conducted Copland's Third Symphony. And then after the symphony, brought Copland up to take a bow. And Copland was very frail at that time, but he was 85. But still, to be on stage with Bernstein and Copland after playing Copland's symphony, it just, that was, mind-blowing experience that I'll never forget. But of the guys now, man, that's a tough thing. I'll tell you, one person I worked with, but not with the orchestra, is Riccardo Muti. I would love to play with Muti with this orchestra. I think he would be unbelievable. I did this group, the National Brass Ensemble, that I put together of principal players from the top seven orchestras. Is loosely based on the original Gabrielli recording from 1968 with the Cleveland, Chicago, and Philly guys. But when we did a concert in Chicago a few years back, we asked Muti to join us. And we ended up doing two Verdi overtures, Forza del Destino and Nabucco, that were arranged for us, that one of our guys arranged, that Muti conducted. So I have played with him, and I've seen him conduct, but he would be the one guy I would have to say that, man, I would love to work with him.
There are so many great young conductors coming up, the Dudamels and the Folettas, and all these young conductors coming up who are really putting a great stamp on the world of music. Do you think they're taking it in a good direction?
It's a little too soon to say. I tell you, there's one guy who is young, who I really like a lot, who just did Beethoven 7 with us in the fall, Klaus Makela, who is the new music director in Oslo, and then also was just named music director in the Paris Opera, I believe. And he's 24, and when I think of him and I saw him, I thought, this is a young Claudio Abbado. I mean, he has Wonderful. That kind of presence and mindfulness and seriousness, yet levity, just the complete package. It was really gigantic talent.
Speaking of gigantic talent, you do a lot of soloing. That's something that a lot of orchestral section players don't do. Do you find it hard crossing over from sitting as a section leader, as a principal trumpet in a trumpet section, to being out front of the orchestra?
It's a little different mindset. I mean, first of all, just from an acoustical standpoint, like someplace like Severance Hall, when I'm back in the principal trumpet chair back toward the back of the stage, a lot of what I have to do to be together with the front stage, I have to do some anticipation and certain note length things, front of notes articulation, dynamic things, any number of different details in what I do to be able to integrate within the orchestra is completely different sitting in the back of the orchestra versus standing up front. Usually what I find when I haven't done it in a little while is that it'll take me about 5 minutes to remember I don't have to anticipate what I'm hearing. I could just kind of play with what I'm hearing and kind of sit back more in it rather than play on the front side of the beat necessarily. But it is a little bit of a different head. I mean, when you're playing a concerto, obviously you're kind of the musical guide for the piece and setting the tone and the character and, you know, the basic expression that, you know, the phrasing and how things are going to go. In the orchestra, most of the time I'm fitting in with a lot of stuff that I'm hearing. And at times as principal trumpet, I do have that luxury of being able to maybe express myself in a little more of an individualistic way than maybe a section player would. Although there are times they do as well. I mean, it's a lot of give and take within the context of things, sure. But you know, playing a concerto and playing in the orchestra is, you know, a very different headspace, to an extent, a little bit of a different conditioning space, just because you're kind of front and center the whole time. Whereas if I'm playing a Mahler symphony, I'm ducking in and out constantly. Even though it's intensive, it's a different kind of intensive. So, you know, I'd say more than anything, it's mental more than physical, but definitely a physical component within that.
So how do you prepare yourself for that? And do you still get nervous in front of your colleagues?
You know, it's funny. You know, I've done it enough that it's kind of like riding a bike, that the first couple minutes I'm kind of thinking to myself, oh, right, that's how this feels. Right, that's how I need to think. Right, that's what I need to do. And I just have to kind of remind myself of that feeling because I've done it enough. But to prepare for it, a lot of times what I'll try to do is I'll try to do a dry run someplace with piano. Just so I get used to the idea of performing the piece. I mean, as I work through anything, there are variations in how I practice. There's the getting into the minutiae and the details, and there's thinking much more overall. So I'm thinking micro and macro. And sometimes I'm thinking both. I'm kind of playing a ping pong game where I'll try to do a long, you know, swatch of something, and then I'll try to break it down into little pieces of aspects that I need to address, and then try to put that back in, try to raising the level of the more overall sense. So I never want to lose the overall sense and overall goal orientation when I'm working and progressing with dealing with the detail orientation. But, you know, my first thing is I got to get the fundamentals and have all those details aligned of what I want to be doing at particular moments and have my signposts set up. And once I have the fundamental details and the more technical details in, I'm always thinking while I'm doing the technical details of the overall expression. So by the time I get to the expression, the undercurrent of layers are all there of the technical aspects. So I'm free to really be thinking of the overall, not having to think, what valves am I going to push down for this note? You know, how am I going to articulate this? Where does my air have to be able to carry off this particular phrase? Everything is already kind of dialed in, then it's just a matter of kind of releasing it and really just being in the moment and being much more in the flow. The best way for me to describe it, it's a lot like being an athlete playing a game, is that, you know, you do, like if you're a basketball player, I like to use, you know, like John Wooden, who was a longtime coach at UCLA. I'm a big disciple of Coach Wooden. And he was all about drilling fundamentals in his practice. He was like, 3 minutes of this, 5 minutes of that, 4 minutes of that, 8 minutes of that. The same thing every single day to align it and reinforce it right, so that by the time you get to the game, instinctively, you're just going to react correctly. So I want to align things to a point where it's just instinctively reinforced correctly and done right, that I'm going to react properly in the game, which is the performance. So the performance, I can just release myself and let myself be in the moment, knowing that I can trust all the stuff that I put into place. So, you know, it's just whether I'm playing a Mahler symphony, a Mozart symphony, you know, a brand new concerto, that acumen in general is still the same paradigm that I go through, you know, the same process that I go through. But, you know, for the concerto, you know, I'm really making sure that everything is in place. And then when it comes time, I'm just thinking about being in the moment and expressing myself.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys. And our guest today on BTM is none other than the Cleveland Orchestra's principal trumpet, Michael Sachs. Have you ever had a major disaster?
Oh, sure.
That you're allowed to talk about?
Oh, yeah.
So what's your best crash and burn story, and how did you recover?
You know, it happened. You know what? I'm going to clean this up and just say stuff happens. You know? Everyone's human. I've heard every great brass player the last 40 years, and I've heard them all absolutely screw something up royally. The difference is that the great ones, it's as if it never happened. And the next thing I come in on, it's like a cannonball with absolute assurance and complete self-confidence. Bernie Edelstein once at an ITG is part of a panel, and somebody asked him, how do you feel when you make a mistake? How do you feel when you miss a note? And he thought about it for a second and said, surprised. And to me, that right there, that's why he was as good as he was. Is if he made a mistake, he was surprised because his preparation was so meticulous and his execution was so great. He was so consistent that if something didn't happen quite right, he was surprised by it. It was never expected. So much of what we do as a musician and as a trumpet player, I could speak as a principal trumpet player in particular, it's all here between my ears. It's all, a lot of it's the mental aspect that you come to. If you come to something thinking that this is hard or this is difficult, you're already behind the eight ball. You're already five steps back. If I think about it as something as being challenging, that's a completely different mindset. That's a mindset of something that I can circumvent with work and you know, some ingenuity. If something's hard and difficult, or I think, man, that's so hard, I'm already putting myself in a negative aspect of, you know, of how I'm approaching this. So I know I sound like some, you know, Tony Robbins tape or something, or positive thinking or something, but a lot of it really is. I mean, it's very akin to sports. I mean, if you, you know, visualize and imagine yourself as a quarterback throwing that perfect, you know, 10-yard out on a dime to somebody and having it be right on the money, you know, or are you envisioning like all the things that can go wrong, that, you know, I'm going to throw it out of bounds or I'm going to throw it short and the corner is going to intercept it and run back for a pick six. I mean, you have to think about what you envision and the goal orientation of that's what's going to happen. That's your intention. And sometimes it doesn't happen. I mean, perfect example. We were doing Strauss Sinfonia Domestica, and 19 bars into the piece, there's a trumpet lick. It goes, boo-dee-bee-ba-ba-bee. I'm singing the wrong pitches, but it goes G, 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 E, C, C, up to a high C, right? And something happened, the conductor kind of gave a little hitch, and I didn't take a really good breath, and I kind of went, blah, 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 and I missed, there's six notes, I missed five of them. I mean, I just disintegrated this. This is a concert. Dave Souter, anytime, especially if I had an important lick or anything, was just like granite. I mean, he was just like a statue. It was the one time I sent something next to me and I look over and he's just kind of doing a full pull, like looking at me like, what? And he literally, he said, what? I'm going to clean it up. He goes, what the heck was that? And I just looked at him and I shrugged. He's like, I don't know. And he just started laughing, you know? It was like, I don't know, man.
Well, you know, I'd gone to a trumpet convention one time and there was a clinic. It was early in the morning. It was a 9 a.m. clinic, give or take. And the clinician, who's a very famous trumpet player from L.A., had come in and he was doing this clinic. And he got out his horn and he blew a few notes and he talked a little bit. And then he started to play something and it just gacked all over it. And then he stopped and kind of straightened his shoulders and tried that again. Played it again and he gacked all over it. And he said, well, you know, this is a perfect time to tell you this lesson. There are some days you're just going to suck. And as long as you know that, you're okay. It's when you think that you're perfect and you can't make a mistake that it'll mess with your head. Mm-hmm. Then he took a breath, straightened out his shoulders, and blew through the rest of that thing like it was nothing. So that's really kind of akin to what you said before, is just be surprised it happened, be ready for it, and move on.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's what the pros do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something like that. I also think about the adage that it was Joe DiMaggio, I believe, who said, you know, because I forget where it was. It was some, might have been some, I don't know, the Yankees were ahead by 20 games or something. It was like a, you know, mid-September game. And, you know, he was still, he dove for something, or he, you know, really was like going flat out. And somebody asked him, it's like, why, what are you doing? And he said, you know, there's somebody in the stands today who probably paid for his ticket and seeing me for the first time, and I owe them that.
Right.
And I kind of feel like it's just, you owe it to give your all. And even if it's a day that you know you're not at your best, you have to figure out a way to navigate it so that the guy who bought the seat up in the balcony with his wife who's on a date night has no idea if you're having the best day of your life or the worst. And that's kind of the way I go about it. Of course, I try to align myself and condition myself so I'm, consistently more often than not at my optimal, in that if there is a fluctuation, it's very, very minimum. I'm not going from, 100 to 60 to 100 to 60. It's from maybe 100 to 96 to 97 to 100 to 93, more, so the fluctuation is very minimal. But there are going to be those days, and you have to be able to mentally understand how to go into your bag of tricks to be able to make it so that maybe internally you feel that way, but nobody, not even your colleagues, notices. And that's, there's kind of an art to that. And it's something that, after doing this for a long time, I've kind of figured out a way to circumvent that. And that's something that I found out kind of early on how I could do that. And that was a very, very important tool to have.
You said something really nice in one of your interviews about your colleagues and about playing a solo out front of the Cleveland Orchestra, is how pleasant it was to stand in front of your colleagues and get to hear them do what they do best, because you spend so much time at the back in the brass section that to be out in front of the strings and the woodwinds and to actually be able to hear them doing their craft, it's a whole nother world, isn't it? But you spend 90% of your time in the back. Do you find you miss that full live orchestral experience?
It's interesting. I mean, I do have a unique perspective because the only thing behind me is percussion. Everything is in front of me, which, I mean, on one hand is really nice because whether I'm playing or not playing, I'm watching everyone. And I've learned so much watching string players play, their bow air and the way that they'll phrase something, the way they'll use their bow stroke or their vibrato. And watching our wind players, watching the way they breathe and the way they move. And I mean, there's so much I've learned having that perspective. And also just audibly understanding, initially when I first got in the orchestra, I would go out and listen when I wasn't playing. So I could understand what I was hearing when I was in the chair versus what's actually getting out and how that translates. So now I understand how the hall works and how to work the acoustics of the room necessarily. Work the room. But when I stand out front, it always amazes me because all of a sudden I'm capturing it from in front of them. And it just, every time, like the first few minutes of a rehearsal like that, and then through the rest of it, it's amazing to hear. I mean, it's so inspiring to hear my colleagues from a different vantage point where I can really enjoy them. Funny enough, unfortunately, the last time I played, I just did Homo Concerto in November. On one of the concerts, I was taking out my spit and I was hearing some stuff. It was like, God, that sounds incredible. And then all of a sudden it was like, I almost missed my next entrance. Because it was like, oh, and I had to shit and ram the thing in there and get back, because I was so catapulted into this, like transported into this other world. It was some, woodwind lick, and a viola answer to the violins. And I was like, God, this sounds incredible. It's like, oh, geez, I got to be playing. I almost forgot where I was.
Do you still feel that sense of awe when you get to sit in the back of that section? Or does it kind of come and go depending on the concert with these people?
No, I know this may sound cliche or corny or whatever. Part of it is the way I came to be here, my path to getting here. It has something to do with that I never take this for granted. I never felt, I had to work very, very hard to earn this. And because, I came kind of late to the game of learning a lot of the repertoire and everything, in some weird way, it's still very fresh for me. And not a day goes by that I walk into Severance Hall that I think, this is my office, that I get, what a great room I get to be in. Acoustically, aesthetically, and every with the history that's there. And maybe it's corny, but I look at, my folder, it says, the Cleveland Orchestra, Trumpet One. And I still sometimes kind of marvel at just like, I get to be that guy for this time. I step back from it, I still marvel at it and really have incredible appreciation for being in the midst of the incredible people I've been around for the last 32 years and am currently, but also just to have that opportunity to be the curator of this chair for the time that I have it. I mean, I took over from Bernie, I took over from Lou Davidson, and you know, whoever takes it over from me, hopefully I can pass it on to them as strong as, or, you know, as strongly as Bernie left it for me. I mean, it's, you know, it's a special thing to be part of that history. I mean, again, another sport, the sports analogies, to be part of that continuum of, you know, these incredible players who have come through and those that are coming in now and to come. I mean, it's an honor to be part of that. And it's an honor that not a day goes by that I don't appreciate a lot.
Well, you're a rock star in the orchestra world. There's very few rock stars in the orchestra world, especially in the brass section. There's one principal in every orchestra that everybody knows who it is. So you're one of a very elite crew of people. Practically every student in high school growing up wanting to go into becoming an orchestral player, they know who you are right off the top. So do you feel pressure when it comes to passing on your knowledge and making sure that the next generation is ready to fill your shoes when that day comes?
I don't know if pressure is the word.
Responsibility, maybe?
I've always loved teaching. I started teaching when I was in Houston. Again, I fall back on my experience of growing up, and you know, I had these wonderful people through elementary, junior high, high school, and then my teachers, you know, my main teachers from the end of high school through, and so many mentors and, you know, older people in this business who, you know, took me under their wing and were incredibly supportive. And they didn't need to do that, but they were incredibly generous and giving and supportive at times that were really formative for me and really gave me a boost that propelled me to what I was able to, you know, enjoy. And I feel in many ways that I owe it to them to pass along what they passed along to me. And that whole vibe of friendship and giving and being generous and being, you know, offering and wanting to give back. And, you know, in many ways it's a cyclical thing. I mean, to me, I can show them respect, you know, these wonderful mentors that gave to me, and I can pass that along. But it's also the cyclical nature of knowing how that felt when they did that for me and wanting to hopefully offer that to others. I mean, and to me, that's one of the great things of music. That's one of the you know, important responsibilities I feel that I have, because it's on their shoulders that we stand. And then, you know, to me, it's up to me to offer what they offered me and hopefully evolve it and hand it off to somebody else who can hopefully evolve it further.
You know, slightly related, when Bob retired, he gave me the C trumpet that he was using as he was playing in there towards the end. So I've got that now. And I had a very good C trumpet previous to that I won't play it anymore, because there's something special about doing whatever I'm doing on this trumpet that Bob gave to me. So it's really important, that teacher-student relationship in music more than practically anything else, to kind of build some trust there and to you're right, carry on that heritage that he learned from Bernie and he learned from Charlie. And I get to enjoy that, the fruit of his labors. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel a responsibility. If somebody asks me a question, I'm more than happy to share them with them and answer if I've got it, or give them some kind of seeds of wisdom that I've learned over the years performing, because I do feel it's my responsibility to let somebody else know. But I'm just a little fish in a little pond. I would think that would be a lot more weight to carry on your shoulders in a bigger pond.
Well, it's the same thing though. I mean, you're in doing that, you're showing respect and appreciation back. You're reflecting that back as you reflect that information forward. And to me, it's a continuum. It's not something that's segmented that way. Right. And when you start looking at it like that, I mean, again, the historian in me, you know, I do love history, and I'm a big, you know, reader of history, and I love doing deep dives into trumpet history and who these people were and what they did and why they did it and how they did it, so that I can understand if I'm going to evolve something forward, I need to understand who did this before me and why it is where it is now and how it became where it is now and how they made those choices. I mean, you asked a while ago about when I first got in the orchestra. you know, how I assimilated. And it was very interesting because when I first got in the orchestra was still a majority of people that George Zell had hired.
Right.
It was just, it was maybe 52, it was a little over 50% when I was hired. But, you know, coming into a section that had been together for 15 years, you know, of course, the last thing I'm going to do is show up and say like, okay, I'm here now to, you know, showcase my talents. I couldn't care less what you guys did before. It's my way now, you know, which some people in a very, very ill-advised way have done in other places. It's kind of big trouble, obviously. But my whole thing was I wanted to come in and show respect. Respect to Bernie, respect to the section, respect for the orchestra, to understand the history, to come in humble, to come in and, you know, fit in, to be ultimately prepared. I mean, to show them that I, that kind of respect, that I would be that prepared to, you know, be ready for anything and be ready to be flexible for anything. So when things would happen in the section early on that wouldn't quite gel, my first thing was to look at them and say, you know, what did Bernie do? What'd you guys do with Bernie? How'd you guys solve this? And then they tell me, and then they say, well, what do you have in mind? And I say, well, you know, I'm thinking this. And they say, yeah, okay, let's try it. And sometimes what I tried worked great and it was different and it fit better for me with the three of them than Bernie with the three of them. But there are other times, other things where it was like, yeah, you know, what I wanted to do didn't work at all. And what Bernie had done with them worked great. And there was a reason it worked great. Of course, I then adjusted and met them. So, you know, between all that communication, we kind of found our own, you know, our own side of kind of logic and way of doing things and our own chemistry. And that's, you know, that to me is a lot of this, that, you know, that understanding and wanting to access the experience and using that experience together to create something new.
How often do the second, third, fourth players in the orchestra throw up ideas, or do they just follow your lead pretty steadily?
You know, it's a combination. I mean, at the end of the day, to an extent, the principal player does kind of set the tone and lead the charge. But at the same time, it's a collaborative effort. I mean, of course, you know, God knows, of course, I don't hear everything and see everything. And they also have different perspectives as, you know, playing their part and how they're fitting in at different moments that, you know, I'd be a fool not to, you know, solicit their input and then be guided by it in many cases. So it's a collaborative effort. And to me, the more of a team effort it can be and the more inclusive I can be, the stronger we are as a unit. Even if necessarily I'm setting a tone, it's still, it includes input and perspective from all of us.
You know, speaking of teams, you worked on the team that developed the one of the newest editions of the Bach trumpet. Now, the trumpet's a pretty basic instrument, really. It's a stretched out tube, and you got one end you're blowing and sound comes out the other end. There's some buttons in the middle sometimes that make a change. It's a pretty basic piece of equipment. But over the years, you know, technology advances happen that make playing an instrument a little different, a little easier, just something different. You were pretty instrumental in the creation of some of Bach's newest designs. Vincent Bach is a very popular trumpet, if for those who aren't familiar. And you helped design some of these. With all the changes in modern technology and engineering, the trumpets now are pretty good. Is there still room to fix these and make them better?
Oh, there's always room for making a better mouse, building a better mousetrap. I mean, the basic design of a trumpet really has not changed much in the last 100 years or so. I mean, the basic design. Some of the construction changed about 40 years ago because of, in this country, EPA regulations.
Right.
You know, the way horns were lacquered, certain ingredients that were toxic, for lack of a better way, you know, and I mean, there were, you know, some lead, lead included. So, I mean, some of the metallurgy has adjusted over time, but, you know, now with what we have access to from a technological standpoint, we can really find out about some of the metallurgy and, you know, it's, you know, I don't know, 70% brass, 20% copper, 10% zinc or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing this out randomly.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, there's so much you can get into that changes the way a trumpet will respond, the way it will sound, the way it will react and ring and resonate. So dialing that in, it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole a little bit. That, I mean, just in the front end of the instrument where you put just the mouthpiece, that alone is a completely like exponential variable.
Right.
You put the mouthpiece into the receiver, how far in the mouthpiece goes, how big an opening where the mouthpiece goes in the receiver. That's called the venturi and the gap. So, and then the lead pipe. What's the taper on the lead pipe? Is the taper, you know, more continuous? Does it get wider? Does it get narrower? How thick is it? So, and then you go down the instrument, and at all these points, there are all these variables that you have to lock into. So it's kind of like this massive soup with about 80 ingredients that you got to stir together just right to get exactly the taste that you want. And so there's a lot of things involved in that. What I find that we're doing a lot of now, because of the technology that we have available, is to really look at the basic designs of the Vincent Bach instruments, which, you know, the Vincent Bach has always been one of the leaders in the industry. Now there's a couple other instrument companies that are major players in the orchestra world, but the Vincent Bach company for a very long time was the industry standard. And what we found was that the basic designs of the last 60 years or so, 65 years, is pretty much the same. It's just how those pieces, some of them have strayed a little bit in the components and how they were made and the metallurgy and the sizing and, you know, little things. All of a sudden, a gram here, a half a gram there, and all of a sudden the instrument's 30 grams heavier than it used to be or lighter than it used to be. So there's all these things that what we're really doing a lot of is reverse engineering and going in and being like, okay, so here's this trumpet from 1959 that I have, a B-flat trumpet that's sensational. And here's a B-flat trumpet from 2020, so basically 61 years later. Okay, what's the difference between these two? And what's the progression of how this starting in 59 became this in 20? And then kind of reverse engineer it and figuring out, you know, what components do we want to keep and what components do we want to try maybe going back, and with new technology, we can also manufacture it a little bit differently, which will create more
consistency.
Hopefully more consistency. I mean, and that's the goal, is more consistency, or maybe there's a way to manufacture it that they couldn't do then that maybe we can tweak now that makes it even better, that evolves it forward. So it's kind of not recreating exactly a historical model and going back in time, but it's recreating that kind of sound and that kind of ease and that kind of, you know, general concept in a modern, you know, a modern configuration.
So what's your level of input in this? Are you working it from a tech aspect, or do you walk in and say, here's what mine sounds like now, here's what I would like it to do, and then do you let the engineers hash that out?
Kind of a combination. There's an engineer and more of a craftsman. And between the two of them, they're bouncing stuff off of me and me off of them. And then I'm play testing it to show the tendencies of what, you know, changing this does this. So, you know, we're always looking for cause and effect and creating more of the right equilibrium and balance within the instrument for that envisioned goal. And in many ways, my C trumpet, which is my primary instrument in the Cleveland Orchestra, is from 1978. And I've only used two of them my entire career that are, you'll understand this because you're trumpet player, that are 20 serial numbers different. And, you know, that are Bach instruments that are almost identical, like they're brother instruments.
The same guy probably put them together.
The same exact guy did put them together when I met him.
Oh,
you know, he's still working at the factory. He's one of the guys who helped make them. But, you know, these two instruments are as close to identical as you can get, and those are the two instruments I've used over my entire career. So I'm kind of an anomaly that way. A lot of guys change instruments, you know, like they change socks. I mean, it's just, you know, but I like my consistency. I like to know what's in my hands. I like to know it does what I need, and I don't want anything more. So why mess with it? And that hopefully lends to my consistency as a performer. But what I'm trying to do is to create something that sounds like those, or maybe sounds better or works better than those. And that's kind of the goal orientation that we haven't gotten there yet. We're getting close. And I think with this latest iteration, some stuff we'll work on actually during this COVID period, you know, is given an opening for us to have some really Talmudic discussions and talk for 3-4 hours about really getting into the like deep weeds on some stuff and really figuring out, okay, what has been going on that we need to get back and get back to. And we think we've earmarked some stuff to even evolve it further than what you even brought up. There's some stuff in the works right now that I'm working on to take it even further. So, you know, it's exciting. And for me, that's the fun. I mean, at this point, you know, I'm not talking about inches or millimeters. You're talking about, you know, micro, you know, portions of millimeters to move it. But that to me is the fun, is like, where are those little tiny places around us that we can still push the envelope a little bit and find something better?
We talk about violin players and the extraordinary investment they have to make in their instruments, the cello players who are playing on the great world famous touring instruments. It's not exactly cheap to be a trumpet player. People think that you just go out, buy a trumpet, and you're good to go. And $2,000 and you're done. The reality is how many do you own?
Well, I mean, I have a collection of instruments going back to about 1830. So, I mean, I have Civil War instruments and all sorts of other stuff, but I own right now 54 instruments.
54. How many do you use on a regular basis? 10?
Yeah, 10 or 12 in a regular rotation. I mean, you've got the C trumpet, which is, if I played a C on a C trumpet, it's the same as playing C on a piano. Right. And then there's a B flat trumpet, which is a little bit bigger, which is a step down. And that's what most kids start on, learn on, play in band through high school. You know, that's one of my primary instruments that I play every day. So B flat and C trumpet. Then there are trumpets in every other key. There are D E flat trumpets that I use. There are piccolo trumpets that I use that are an A B flat. And those are pretty much the major components. Then there are cornets, German rotary valve trumpets, post horns, G trumpets, F trumpets, flugelhorns. You know, there's all sorts of bugles. There's all sorts of different stuff across the landscape that you use for specialty items. But for the most part, there are pretty much four instruments. My piccolo, my D E flat, my C and my B flat that are kind of my primary stable of instruments, and everything. There's all these other auxiliaries that I'll dabble in here and there. And within that, the B flat and C trumpet, I'm probably using 90% of the time conservatively. But to buy those, yeah, you know, you mentioned $2,000. Yeah, to get a new Bach C trumpet or a new Bach B flat trumpet right now is roughly about $2,900, $3,000.
Right.
To get a new DE flat trumpet is probably about $4,500, and a new piccolo trumpet is probably about $4,500. So you're talking about, you know, now you're talking about $15,000. That would buy you a marginal bow for a violin or cello.
Right, exactly.
You know,
but it's still not a cheap investment for a kid coming right out of college.
No,
yeah.
No, it's not a cheap investment, but you know, you can also find used equipment for, you know, a fraction of that. That would be right. Tremendous if you know where to look and have the right guidance.
Well, you know, one piece of advice I always give to parents when they call and they say, hey, my kid's going to take up trumpet. He's starting this year. What should I get him? And they're like, I found this wonderful trumpet on eBay for $125. And I said, and you will hate your life if you buy them this trumpet. I said, go ahead and make the investment in a decent Yamaha student trumpet. You can find a nice Bach student trumpet. There's so many brands that make good quality instruments for just a little bit more than that. But the reality is just going cheap isn't the way to start somebody, is it?
No, going cheap isn't the way to start. But again, if you have the right guidance and you know where to look, you can find something that's very reasonable and very economic and appropriate you know, you don't have to spend $1,000 on a trumpet. I mean, you can get something that's more than useful and, you know, for half that. I mean, if you know, again, if you know where to look and you know what you're looking for, and it's important. It's also important if you're starting out, you have to have something that really is ergonomically and useful, ergonomically correct and useful, because if it's a dog, you're not going to enjoy playing it. And right. To me, the whole thing about being in music is about having fun. First and foremost, you got to have fun. Otherwise, why do it? I mean, if I didn't enjoy doing this as much as I do, I'd sell my horns or turn them into lamps. I mean, it's just, it's you know, I go do something else. I mean, I love what I do. And the more I do it, the more I love it. And it's just, I'm very lucky to be, you know, have this opportunity that I have. But, you know, I love it when I see kids taking it up and just having a great time. It doesn't, they don't have to be a musician. They don't need the pressure. They got enough, you know, just have a good time, or wherever it takes you, and, you know, maybe end up playing in a rock band or playing in a combo, or playing in a big band, or playing in an orchestra, or playing your town band. I mean, there are so many different avenues to travel with music that anyone and everyone can do it and just have a great time with it. And that's, you know, I just kind of stumbled into it and happened to, you know,
find what you love.
One led to another, and I went, you know, I took the fork in the road and went down this path and didn't look back. And it just kind of serendipitously kind of happened. But, you know, I love when kids take it up and they just have a great time, and they just, you know, people who put too much pressure on kids with music. I mean, the way I'm wired, I was lucky that growing up, my parents didn't levy a lot of pressure. I mean, basically they just said, look, if you want to do this, the deal is we'll pay for lessons if you take responsibility to practice.
Right.
If we see you messing around and not practicing and not taking it serious enough and not taking the responsibility, then we'll know that you're not interested in doing this. So, we'll, you know, you can do something else. But as long as you want to do this, as long as you want to practice, and, you know, you know, that's your thing.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR.
Well, you know, you did turn it into something more fun than just playing with the Cleveland Orchestra. You play the national anthem at dozens of Cleveland Indian games, from what I understand. You're a huge baseball fan, I take it.
Yeah, I live for baseball, man. This goes back, my parents grew up in Brooklyn, going to Ebbets Field and watching the Dodgers. And then they moved out to L.A., where I grew up in Santa Monica. They moved out to L.A. 2 years after the Dodgers did. They moved out in 60. And I was born in 61. And my mom always told me the story, how she went to the Coliseum. This is pre-Dodger Stadium. She went to the Coliseum to see Koufax pitch when she was pregnant with me.
Wow. So that was your blessing.
That was my blessing. But no, I mean, I went to a ton of Dodger games growing up. I went to the 78 World Series. I went to a couple games with my mom. I mean, I love baseball, and getting to play the national anthem at the Indians game. I haven't, unfortunately, done it in a while. I'd love to do it, but I was lucky enough to play the last game in the old stadium, in Municipal Stadium, and the first game at what was then Jacobs Field.
Wow.
And then a bunch of other opening days, played the first playoff game in 95, played a championship game in 97, another playoff game in 99. To be on the field with those guys, you know, under some of those circumstances, was one of the great joys and honors of my life, man. I mean, I look, all things being equal, I would have loved to have played baseball. I would have loved to have played for the Dodgers. But, you know, I got thrown a little different direction, and, you know, but I still get to play out that whole athletic acumen with, you know, the preparation and the game, you know, the concert. And, you know, but I love baseball. I love watching it. I love playing it. And actually, one of the guys in the orchestra, I don't know if you know this, one of the violinists in the orchestra, one of my closest friends, is like a brother to me, Scott Weber, that I've known for 35 years. His son, Andy, grew up in Aurora, went to University of Michigan, was drafted by the Cubs as one of their top prospects coming up as a middle
infielder. How nice is that? So, yeah. You know, you're really centrally located there in Cleveland. Do you ever have any friendly wagers with your friends in Detroit or your friends in Pittsburgh His friends in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
With whose team's going to do better that season?
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, I I'm, you know, a Cleveland guy, you know, in the AL and a Dodger guy in the NL. So, you know, with the Dodgers, I'm dealing with, you know, the Giant, you know, fans, all my friends in San Francisco. With Cleveland, I'm dealing with all the Yankee fans. And I mean, my parents instilled in me from birth that I hate the Yankees.
But hate the Yankees.
So, you know, I'm all over that. So I'm all over my Yankee fan friends. And, you know, of course there's, you know, some, you know, Cincinnati, you know, Pittsburgh stuff rolling around, a little Detroit stuff as well. But no, I actually, Scott Weber and I had season tickets for a very long time, from the last year in the Municipal Stadium through, oh gosh, maybe up until about 10 years ago, we had season tickets. So we had season tickets for a good 16, 17 years, and went to all the playoff and World Series games in the 90s, and, you know, ton of games every year. And it was a blast, man. It was a blast. And then, of course, when they were in the series with the Cubs a few years ago, Scott and I went to all the home games. So we got to see, you know, games 1, 2, 6, and 7.
That's exciting. You know, it's wonderful when you see a musician who can also enjoy some athletics, because so often it feels like it's us versus them, you know, but it doesn't have to be.
Oh,
Arturo
no.
Sandoval plays national anthems at games all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I'm a giant sports fan. I'm a big Browns fan, Cavs fan. Yeah, when the Cavs, you know, when LeBron was here in those finals runs, I took my daughter to all the finals games because she really wanted to be a part of it. So I've completely spoiled her, because those are the only Cavs games she's ever been to, except for one when she went with a friend whose father had floor seats. So my daughter's whole, her whole perspective is so completely off base skewed that she's been to, you know, she's either had floor seats or been to the NBA finals. And, you know, and had really good seats for that. So, I mean, her whole perspective is complete. I mean, I tried to explain to her, it's like, do you understand what this, you know, what this means to be here and be in this environment? It's like, yeah, I get to see LeBron and, you know, oh, there's Beyonce over there and whatever other celebrity she wanted to check out.
Yeah.
I just stopped trying. You know, but that, you know, but to be a part of that with her. You know, in some ways, the full circle of, you know, being there at the World Series with my mom and going to, we had season tickets to the Rams when they're at the Coliseum in L.A. and, you know, going with my mom, who was this petite lady of 5'1", but that can out-yell anyone in the stadium. I mean, she was hollering, as she would, but she would scream and yell, I mean, just constantly. And this is very much her personality. You know, she was always convinced that the refs were in cahoots with the other team, and some conspiracy against whoever she was rooting for, whether it was the Dodgers, it was the umps, or the Rams, it was the refs. And, you know, there was always that. But, you know, but then to get to share that with my daughter is one of the great things I've ever experienced.
Again, special thanks go to Michael Sachs and the Cleveland Orchestra for making this episode of Better Than Monkeys possible. And we will have a part two of this exciting interview with the Cleveland Orchestra's own Michael Sachs next month, right here on WQLN NPR's original podcast, Better Than Monkeys. If you'd like more information on Michael Sachs, you can find it on his website, michaelsachs.com. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes of Better Than Monkeys, well, of course, you can find those at WQLN's webpage, wqln.org/BTM, or on any major podcast platform. Again, I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN NPR.